Chapter 24, Israel Part 3, Terrorism and Treachery Against the United States.
It begins with a quotation by Dean Rusk, the U.S. Secretary of State at the time of the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty in June 1967. And Rusk has made statements on this line over the last 40 years concerning this subject. Rusk has told the American people, and again, he was U.S. Secretary of State at the time of the Israeli attack, that Israel purposefully and deliberately attacked the USS Liberty. Here we go. On June 8, 1967, an American Navy intelligence ship, the USS Liberty, patrolling off the waters of Israel and the Gaza Strip, came under the fire of jet fighter aircraft and torpedo boats. I recall that I heard the news from my transistor radio while I was at my summer job, scraping the old paint off a house in New Orleans' Lakeview section. The attack occurred during the Arab-Israeli War of 1967, a war in which America supported Israel. The first news accounts did not identify the attacking parties, and I assumed, as did most Americans, that the Egyptians, in a supremely brutal and stupid attack, had struck a U.S. vessel in retaliation for our massive support of the Israeli military. Immediately after the first reports of the attack came in, a few elected officials had already begun to call for immediate military retaliation against Egypt. In spite of my growing knowledge of the pernicious nature of Zionism, my deeply embedded patriotism came pouring out. I became angry at Egypt for daring to attack an American vessel. Later on, reports finally began to filter in that it was the Israelis who had attacked the American ship, wounding 173 Americans and killing 34. The official excuse was that the Israelis had mistaken the Liberty for an Egyptian ship. Over the next few weeks, a great deal of evidence emerged revealing that the attack had been deliberate. Still, the major media practically dropped all the stories of the USS Liberty and its 202 American casualties in deference to stories of gallant little Israel fighting its heroic war with Egypt and Lebanon. The crew had been ordered not to divulge any information about the attack. When the silence was finally broken years later by Lieutenant James Eanes, an officer aboard the Liberty, the overwhelming evidence revealed a murderous and treacherous attack by the Israelis on an American ship. The USS Liberty, a lightly armed intelligence ship whose mission was to intercept foreign radio communications, had been sailing in international waters off the Egyptian town of El Arish, which Israeli forces had just captured. Israel knew that the Liberty was monitoring its transmissions, and it was fearful it would learn of preparations for a planned invasion of Syria. Also, the Liberty had intercepted Israeli radio communications showing that they had murdered hundreds of unarmed Egyptian prisoners of war in the Sinai. On the clear and breezy morning of June 8, Israeli fighter jets circled the Liberty numerous times, coming in so low and so close that the ship's crewmen waved at the pilots and could actually see their faces. The Liberty was a clearly marked U.S. Navy vessel with large U.S. Navy identifying letters, and it had a huge American flag flying stiffly in the breeze of a clear day. With no warning, at 2 p.m., unmarked Israeli jets attacked the Liberty with rockets, cannon fire, and napalm bombs. Their first target was the radio room, which they destroyed along with the Liberty's antennas. The fighters made repeated passes, attacking the ship until they ran out of bombs and ammo and broke off the attack. At that point, the men of the Liberty replaced the first American flag, which had been shot away, with an oversized 7-by-13-foot flag. Well, the Israelis obviously knew the ship was American, as they intercepted and tried to electronically jam the Liberty's radio signals for help. Incredibly, the Liberty's radio signals had been able to be released because the operators had managed to rig up a new antenna and get a distress call through. And the distress call, to the bad luck of Israel, identified the attackers and requested help from the Mediterranean Sixth Fleet. The carrier Saratoga and America sent messages that help was on the way and dispatched fighters to defend the Liberty. The beleaguered and bloodied crew of the Liberty waited in vain for the promised fighter support as Israeli torpedo boats then attacked, trying to sink the Liberty and finish off the crew who were now fighting the napalm fires on the decks and tending to the wounded. The Israelis raked the Liberty with 20 and 40 millimeter cannon fire and struck the ship with a torpedo at the waterline, killing 22 more sailors below the decks. The torpedo boats came in close enough to machine gun the crew tending to the wounded on the deck. Despite 821 holes, each bigger than a man's fist, napalm bombs exploding on the decks and in the superstructure, and a gaping hole and serious torpedo damage at the waterline, miraculously, the USS Liberty remained afloat. No thanks to the U.S. fighter support, which never came, for they had been called back by orders of President Lyndon Johnson before they could intercept the attackers. Israel obviously intended to sink the Liberty and kill everyone on board. In violation of international law, Israel torpedo boats even machine gunned the Liberty's deployed life rafts. They sought to knock out the Liberty's communication room and jam her radio signals to prevent her from identifying her attackers, and then to send the American ship and her crew to the bottom, so no one could refute the natural supposition that the treacherous deed had been committed by the Egyptians. The Zionists knew that by knocking out the Liberty, they would have more of a free hand in Syria, and the indignation over the sinking of an American ship by the Egyptians would garner unconditional support for Israel's most radical war aims. Only the courage and resourcefulness of the men of the USS Liberty prevented that further miscarriage of justice. In his recall of the U.S. Navy jets sent to protect the Liberty, Johnson committed one of the most treasonous acts of betrayal in American history. He cared more about preventing a public breach between the U.S. and Israel than saving the lives of American fighting men. The survivors of the Liberty have stated clearly that had the jets not been recalled, the torpedo boat attack could have been stopped, saving many American lives. Captain William McGonagall, the Liberty's commanding officer, although seriously wounded, showed exceptional heroism that eventually won him the Congressional Medal of Honor. Usually the president awards the nation's highest honor in a White House ceremony along with a citation recording the details of the heroic deed. President Johnson called the Israelis to see if they had any objection to the awarding of the medal, and then decided not to take part in the ceremony or even allow it at the White House. The Secretary of the Navy ended up awarding the medal at the Washington Naval Yard, and the citation did not even identify Israel as the attacker. The Washington Post ran no story about Captain McGonagall receiving the award. The U.S. Navy conducted a perfunctory court of inquiry lasting only 4 days and failed to call even one Israeli to testify. Lieutenant James Eanes, one of the Liberty's officers, wrote a detailed book about the incident called Assault on the Liberty, published in 1979. It exposes the tremendous evidence showing how the attack was a calculated and deliberate attempt to sink a ship the Israelis knew was American and kill any survivors so there would be no American witnesses. The U.S. ambassador to Lebanon at the time has also come forward and stated that when he was on duty in the Middle East, he heard U.S. intercepted Israeli communications with the attacking Israeli fighters, acknowledging the ship was American. Many prominent leaders of the U.S. Navy courageously have gone on record to demand a real inquiry on the Liberty. And the head of Navy operations said that the evidence clearly pointed to a planned attack. Secretary of State Dean Rusk, Admiral Thomas Moore, and the surviving crew of the USS Liberty all say the attack was clearly deliberate. Perhaps one could understand such a treacherous act from stated enemies of our country, but not from a supposed ally. The fact that Israel had attacked the forces of the nation that has supported it more than any other, with money, diplomacy, goodwill, and even military arms, including the very weapons that were turned against our men, has to be one of the most egregious acts of military betrayal in the history of nations. I asked myself how Israel could be so reckless as to attack an American vessel. The obvious answer was that they knew their operation against the Liberty held very little risk, for if the attack succeeded and the ship and all of its crew were destroyed, Israel would get everything it wanted in the war. If they failed in their mission to sink the Liberty and blame it on the Egyptians, the Israelis knew they could pass it off as a mistake. They also knew that their massive influence in the American government and the press would help them cover up their treachery. After sweeping the terror and dispossession of 1.5 million Palestinians under the rug for half a century, hiding the treachery against the USS Liberty was child's play. The Jewish-dominated American media expressed no outrage for the attack and supinely accepted the specious Israeli excuse for it. Even though our own Secretary of State and our own Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said the Israeli attack was deliberate, the Jewish lobby was even able to prevent a formal congressional inquiry into the attack. In contrast, the USS Liberty's sister ship, the USS Pueblo, was captured by North Korea the following year, 1968, with a loss of only one life. Yet within a year, the U.S. Congress launched a lengthy and formal inquiry into that attack. And still, as of this writing and of this audio book, there has been no formal inquiry into the attack on the USS Liberty. As a side note, I want to remind you as well that the members of the crew of the Liberty were threatened with court-martial and prison if they dared to talk about this attack to the press and reveal its details to the media about what Israel did to them. How did the political leaders of the United States respond to the Israeli act of war against it? Did America bomb Tel Aviv as it did Kabul, Afghanistan? No. The Israeli-controlled American government, along with the Jewish-controlled media, committed a clear case of treason against America by covering up this vicious terrorist surprise attack. And it continues to send billions of American tax dollars to Israel in military and monetary aid. I must invoke the example of Pearl Harbor. Any American government official who had given aid or comfort to Japan after the attack in 1941 would have been prosecuted as a traitor to the United States. I charge those American government officials who collaborate with the Jewish lobby and the Jewish-dominated media in continuing to support Israel after its attack on the USS Liberty are traitors against the United States of America. When I learned the full truth of the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty a few weeks after the actual attack, I remembered how incensed I had felt when I heard on my transistor radio how the Egyptians had apparently attacked an American ship. Those moments of anger had long passed when years later I read Eanes' book. However, Eanes' poignant accounts of the dead and dying men aboard the Liberty caused another anger to rise in me. Again, only to give way to profound sadness for my country. As a young and proud American, I could not understand how our president could treasonously refuse to defend American men under fire. How could our government willingly cover up the intentional Israeli murder of Americans and even reward the murderers with even more billions of our tax money in foreign aid? The incident shocked me so much that it drove me to research Israel's true record of terrorism and treachery against the United States. And I learned very quickly that the Liberty was not the first Israeli act of terrorism and treachery against the United States. This section is called The Levant Affair, Israeli Terrorism Against America. In 1954, the Israeli government launched a secret operation of terror against the United States called Operation Susanna. It plotted to murder Americans and blow up American installations in Egypt. Their plan was to leave false evidence to indicate that the Egyptians committed the terrorist acts so as to make America go to war against Egypt on the side of Israel. Jewish agents succeeded in blowing up some post offices and American libraries in Cairo and Alexandria. On the way to blow up an American movie house, the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Theater, an Israeli's agent's bomb went off prematurely. Thankfully, for both Egypt and for America, the plot was then exposed and stopped in its early stages. Because of the capture of the Israeli agents, the world learned of the Israeli treachery, and the Israeli foreign minister, Pinhas Levon, was later forced to resign. The whole episode became known as the Levon Affair. Today, the Jewish-dominated American media and publishing establishment deftly cover up this Israeli treachery against us. Most Americans know nothing about it. For instance, only a slight mention of the Levant Affair is found in the popular Encarta Encyclopedia. Now, the reference can be found in an article about Ben-Gurion authored by the Zionist Bernard Reich. It is appropriate to note that the article's author illustrates a typical media and academic pattern. When Americans suppose they are reading an unbiased encyclopedia or news magazine account, they more often than not are reading a purposefully distorted account written by ardent Jewish Zionists. Here is the exact wording of its reporting of this Israeli acts of terrorism against America. Quote, Ben-Gurion returned to politics in 1955 to replace Minister of Defense Pinhas Levon, who resigned after a failed attempt to sabotage Egypt's relations with the West. Period. Unquote. Note how the article meekly says, quote, a failed attempt to sabotage Egypt's relations with the West. Unquote. What does this mean to the reader? Sabotaging relations sounds as though Israel might have just said a few nasty things about Egypt and America behind each other's back. The intentional deception used in this article by its Jewish author is typical of the distortions that go on countless times in the mass media. Now, the line in Encarta should read, quote, who was forced to resign after Israel was caught committing terrorist bombings against the United States in order to treacherously and unjustly incite America into a war against an innocent nation. Unquote. I am sure that 90% of those who now hear these lines or read these lines in my book have never heard of the Levant Affair. If you still might doubt that Israel has committed this terrorist plot against America and Egypt, here's a quote from a recent article appearing in the Jewish magazine Moment, written by Samuel Katz and meant for its small Jewish audience. The article is more forward than the Encarta reference, yet it still omits the provocative word terrorism, a word Israel uses when Palestinians blow up Israeli army units. Quote, and the failures were as common as the spectacular successes. In the mid-1950s, Amman, the Jewish Defense Agency, suffered a serious setback during the infamous Operation Susanna when Israeli agents provoked Jews in Egypt to attack American and British targets and incite anti-Western sentiment. Many Jews were arrested and some were executed. The bungled operation was a severe embarrassment for the government of Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion and his defense minister, Pinhas Levon. unquote. So in the Levant affair, we learned how our so-called best friend in the Middle East, Israel, rewards the United States for its unconditional monetary and military support by committing terrorism against us. Ponder the fact that most Americans have never even heard about this Israeli terrorist attack against our people. If the Egyptian government had been behind this terror against America, we would have rightly considered it an act of war, and we would have gone to war against Egypt and bombed it unmercifully, just as we've done against Afghanistan. And the media, they would have clamored for such attacks, just as they demanded attacks against Afghanistan after the September 11 attacks of 2001. In fact, we attacked Afghanistan on far less grounds than we had for attacking Israel. No evidence existed that Afghanistan approved of or even knew anything about the attack on the World Trade Center. But in the Levant affair, the Israeli government itself had committed a direct act of war against the United States of America. America, though, of course, did not bomb Tel Aviv in retaliation. America did not sever its diplomatic relations with Israel. In fact, we did not even cut off our billions of dollars in monetary and military aid. And the question is, why not? Again, I invoke the example of Pearl Harbor. As I did in recounting the attack on the USS Liberty, any American government official who would have given aid to the Japanese after the attack on Pearl Harbor would have been prosecuted as a traitor to the United States. Let me be perfectly blunt. Those Americans and government who continued our support of Israel after it had committed terrorist attacks against the people of the United States clearly committed treason against the United States. If only American leaders, after Israel's attack against us, the terrorist attack of the Levant affair, or after the attack on the Liberty, would simply have stopped their treasonous aid to Israel, there would have been no subsequent acts of terror against us, such as in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon attacks. What further acts of terrorism could we prevent by stopping the flow of our money and military arms to Israel right now? The next section is ongoing Israeli treachery, the Pollard affair. In the 1980s, Israel recruited an American Jew, Jonathan Pollard, to spy against the United States. After his apprehension, Israeli officials at first claimed he was a, quote, rogue agent, unquote, but later they admitted that Pollard was working for them from the beginning. Other than the Jewish spies, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, who gave her atom bomb secrets to the Soviets, probably no spies have ever done more damage to our country than that which was done by this single Israeli spy, Jonathan Pollard. Israel's use of Pollard's information not only destroyed our intelligence operations in the Mideast, it practically destroyed our intelligence apparatus in the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. Many of America's most loyal and best agents in the communist world were executed because Israel sold or bartered Pollard's stolen information to the Soviets. As the article below by Eric Margolis explains, America's supposed wonderful friend and ally, Israel, would not even allow the United States to debrief the Mossad agents who handled the Pollard spy case. They wouldn't even let us determine the full extent of the damage done to the United States and the dangers posed to American agents overseas. Some of the enormously sensitive secrets stolen by Pollard were sold or bartered by Israel to the Soviet Union. Here's a quotation directly from this article. A number of key CIA agents in the East Bloc were allegedly executed as a result of Pollard spying. The KGB likely gained access to top secret U.S. codes, either directly from Israel or through spies in Israel's government. In short, Pollard's treachery caused one of the worst security disasters in modern U.S. history. So, Israel, which receives billions in American aid, has continuously and treacherously spied on and broken the very security of the United States. To further demonstrate their contempt for us, they even bartered the top secret information they had stolen from us to America's worst enemies. Even after Israel's public relations apologies for the Pollard spying and after assuring American officials it would never happen again, it has continued to spy on us. Los Angeles Times, 1997, reported that an American Jew named David A. Tenenbaum admitted to divulging secrets to Israel. To quote the Los Angeles Times, quote, a civilian engineer working at the Army Command facility near Detroit has admitted divulging classified military information to Israeli officials over the last 10 years. After the September 11, 2001 attacks in the World Trade Center, 140 Jews were held by the FBI for spying, including major Jewish intelligence operatives. Here's a quote from the Fox News Network, Washington. Some 60 Israelis, who federal investigators have said are part of a long-running effort to spy on American government officials, are among the hundreds of foreigners detained since the September 11 terror attacks, Fox News has learned. Numerous classified documents obtained by Fox News indicate that even prior to September 11, as many as 140 other Israelis had been detained or arrested in a secretive and sprawling investigation into suspected espionage by Israelis in the United States. Documents, they say, targeted and penetrated military bases, the DEA, FBI, and dozens of other government facilities, and even secret offices and unlisted private homes of law enforcement and intelligence personnel. The majority of those questions stated that they served in military intelligence, electronic surveillance, intercept, or explosive ordnance units. Quote, why would Israelis spy in and on the U.S.? A General Accounting Office investigation referred to Israel as a country A and said, according to U.S. intelligence agency, the government of country A conducts the most aggressive espionage operations against the U.S. of any U.S. ally. Unquote. A defense intelligence report said Israel has a voracious appetite for information and said the Israelis are motivated by strong survival instincts which dictate every possible facet of their political and economic policies. It aggressively collects military and industrial technology, and the U.S. is a high priority target. The document concludes Israel possesses the resources and the technical capability to achieve its collection objectives. And the last paragraph, there are other things to consider. In the days ahead, we'll take a look at the U.S. phone system and law enforcement's methods for wiretaps and an investigation that both have been compromised by our friends, which implied the Israelis, overseas. Unquote. It is impossible to overstate the extent of treason going on in the United States government on behalf of Israel, even after the terrible damage of the Pollard spy case. American government officials gave the contract for U.S. government wiretaps within the United States to an Israeli firm funded by the Israeli government. Every American can obviously understand the immense damage that can be caused from a foreign government spying on us. Spying has always been prosecuted by every nation as one of the most serious crimes, and justly so. A very legitimate question is, why does the American government tolerate Israel's spying and treachery against our country? And how can our leaders tolerate the treason that has become so commonplace in our government? President Bush should have simply said to Israel, America does not have to give you billions of American tax dollars. We do not have to diplomatically support your terrorism and supremacy in the United Nations. The least we should have expected in return is that you do not spy on us and betray us. Since you have repeatedly committed treachery against us, that's it. You don't get another dime. Furthermore, if you commit any more treachery against America, we will answer it with military response, a military response that will make our attack on the Taliban look like child's play. Well, I guess that's a response we can only wish for. We're never going to get that kind of response from George Bush. The fact that no American official would make such a statement is proof of Israel's power over them, and it offers clear evidence of the treason that prospers in the American government. Even after Israel repeatedly proved its willingness to spy on us and critically damage America's intelligence operations, President Clinton appointed a dedicated Zionist Jew as chairman of the National Security Council, the highest and most sensitive intelligence position in the White House. Even the Israeli daily Maariv referred to Berger as a, quote, warm Jew, meaning that he's devoted to Israel first. Appointing Berger as National Security Council chief after the Pollard case is pure insanity. President Bush continued the same insanity of putting those loyal to Israel in the most sensitive positions in the U.S. government. In the National Security Council, there's been increasing Jewish consolidation from the first days of the Bush presidency. Richard Sale of UPI on February 28, 2003, wrote about Zionist Elliot Abrams. A staff shakeup, this is a quote, a staff shakeup at the National Security Council is likely to mean the United States will take a harder pro-Israel stance in the Middle East. Elliot Abrams, the former controversial Reagan administration official who President Bush last December appointed to the NSC to take charge of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, has removed several staff members who were regarded as even-handed on the issue. That's a direct quote from UPI. The fact that Israel could commit these outrages against the United States without suffering scathing media attacks and causing at least the cutoff of American aid to Israel, if not placing Israel on our enemies list, shows their absolute supremacism over the American establishment. It's no wonder that Ariel Sharon could make the following statement to Simon Peres when he suggested that Israel might lose American aid if it did not pull back recent Israeli incursions into the West Bank. Sharon responded, quote, every time we do something, you tell me America will do this and will do that. I want to tell you something very clear. Don't worry about America. American pressure on Israel. We, the Jewish people, control America, and the Americans know it. It's October 3, 2001. Jonathan Pollard is not the only American who has committed treason against America. All those in the American government who would continue to monetarily and militarily support a foreign nation that commits terrorism against us, spies on us, and severely damages our intelligence operations, along with causing the deaths of American agents, have committed treason against the United States of America. In response to these ongoing acts of terrorism and treachery against the United States, a truly patriotic American government would have, at the very least, ended our support for Israel. Supporting a foreign nation after it willfully commits such acts of treachery against America is nothing less than treason. The fact that billions of dollars of American taxpayer support to Israel does not miss a single beat is but one more indicator of the power of Jewish supremacism over the American establishment. This section is entitled Jewish Treachery and the 9/11 Attacks. Examining the reaction of the American media and government to the terrorist attacks of September 2001 shows the power of Jewish supremacism over them. While the fires were still burning in the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, Jewish partisans in the media carefully began conditioning the minds of the American people so that these attacks would help the Israeli cause. The major news networks ran a videotape of a small group of Palestinian kids supposedly celebrating the news of the strike against America, and then aired it every 5 or 10 minutes, juxtaposed to the spectacular carnage of the burning World Trade Center and soot-covered Americans crying in horror. In truth, every major Palestinian organization condemned the attacks, and not even a single Palestinian was implicated in the attacks. Interestingly enough, the Jerusalem Post reported that Israelis, who later turned out to be spies and terrorists, nearby the World Trade Center in New York, were detained by the FBI after they were spotted videotaping and whooping with glee as the Twin Towers burned. Repeatedly running the tape of a few Palestinian rowdies was an especially cheap shot that left a powerful anti-Palestinian impression seared into the consciousness of millions of Americans already traumatized by the horrible scenes of destruction they witnessed on their television set. The big lie.
Almost immediately after the attacks, the media began to parrot a huge lie about why the event happened so as to protect Israel's image and maximize American hatred for Israeli enemies. There were two main parts to the lie. First, the media solemnly announced that the attacks had absolutely nothing to do with American support of the criminal and terrorist policies of Israel. Now, it's vital to the Jewish supremacists that the American people do not fully realize the huge national and personal costs of our Israeli-controlled foreign policy. Americans might begin to ask why we have a policy that so hurts America and that even brings terrorism to our shores. The media cannot afford people to ask those kinds of logical questions, so they had to manufacture an explanation for the attack that left out Israel. Jewish ultra-supremacist Benjamin Netanyahu actually had the chutzpah to appear before a congressional hearing on the incident and claim that the Arab world hates America so much that it is Israel that suffers from its association with the United States. Quote, "Thus the soldiers of militant Islam do not hate the West because of Israel. They hate Israel because of the West." Netanyahu told America not to worry, however, because loyal little Israel would still stand behind the United States, even though it has been ruining its sterling reputation with the Arabs by associating with us. President Bush should have immediately responded by telling the Israelis that we're very sorry for hurting Israel's image among the Arabs, and so we'll solve that problem for them by cutting off our billions of dollars of support and diplomatic shoring up of Israel before the United Nations. Secondly, the media repeatedly alleged that the attackers simply did it because they hate American freedom. The attack on freedom argument was repeated incessantly by the media. Even George Bush repeated that canard in his speech to the U.S. Congress. He said, and I quote, "Americans are asking, why do they hate us? They hate what they see right here in this chamber, a democratically elected government. Their leaders are self-appointed. They hate our freedoms. Our freedom of religion, our freedom of speech, our freedom to vote and assemble and disagree with each other." Unquote. The media did not bother to tell the American people that the attack occurred on the anniversary of the League of Nations proclamation of the British Mandate, which was made public in Palestine on September 11, 1922. The British Mandate was the first major step toward implementation of the Balfour Declaration, the founding of the Jewish state in what is now Israel. September 11 is a day of infamy for the Palestinians, and the Arabs who oppose America apparently sought the same for the United States. The media bosses had to know of the significance of that date, but no major news source even mentioned it. The date can be found in many historical dating indexes, including important dates in history. At the same time the media blamed bin Laden for being the mastermind behind the attack, they told us he did it because he hates American freedom. The media knew such claptrap was a blatant lie. Every media outlet in the world has full access to his past interviews. Laden has never said a word against democracy or freedom. In 1998, ABC News interviewed Mr. bin Laden and asked him about the previous attack on the World Trade Center. He praised the attackers and gave reasons why he opposes America. Here are some excerpts of the broadcast by ABC. Quote, "I say to them that they, Americans, have put themselves at the mercy of a disloyal government, and this is most evident in Clinton's administration. We believe that it represents Israel inside America. Take the sensitive ministries, such as the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense and the CIA, and you'll find that the Jews have the upper hand in them. They make use of America to further their plans for the world. For over half a century, Muslims in Palestine have been, by the Jews, slaughtered and assaulted and robbed of their honor and of their property. Their houses have been blasted, their crops destroyed. Unquote. The Jewish media knew why America was attacked from day one. They knew it all along. It was because of our Israel First foreign policy. The media bosses had a meeting and decided to air no more interviews with bin Laden, except for government-approved excerpts, so they could perpetuate their lies about his motivations. They knew that the attackers viewed America as under control of Zionists and that it has been used to support Israel's terrorism and to attack and murder Israel's enemies, saying the September 11 suicide bombers attacked America because they hate democracy. This is ridiculous as saying wolves eat rabbits because they hop. The truth is that wolves do not eat rabbits because they hop, but because they're food. An Arab terrorist struck at America not because it's a democracy, but because they believed that terrorism against us was justified for our support of the Israeli terrorism against them. The world has not read about any plane bombs crashing into Switzerland or into Iceland, to much longer enduring democracies. The absolutely absurd big lie about attacking democracy was promoted to cover up the obvious truth that the terrorist acts happened in retaliation for America's unconditional support for the terrorist state of Israel and its leader, one of the world's most bloodstained terrorists, Ariel Sharon. The Jewish supremacist media felt compelled to lie and divert people with a bogus reason for the terrorist attacks. If Americans clearly understood the fact that our pro-Israeli policy was the primary cause of this enormous tragedy, people might ask obvious questions, such as, is America's support of Israel really worth it? Is it worth the lives of 2,800 American victims lost on 9/11? Is it worth the $1 trillion of damage suffered by our economy? Is it worth the $200 billion of American taxpayers' money sent to Israel since its inception? Is it worth the additional trillions of dollars we have spent for higher petroleum costs, the Arab oil weapon response to our pro-Israel policies? Is it worth the enormous dangers of biological, chemical, and nuclear terrorism upon the American people? Is it worth the loss of our precious constitutional rights and freedoms? Is it worth making 99% of the people of the Mideast and most of the people of the world hate us to please a nation that commits treachery against us? Is it worth it to support a nation created by terrorism and ethnic cleansing and whose leader is a longtime terrorist who is responsible for the death of 1,500 men, women, and children, refugees in Lebanon? Is it worth it to support a nation that has committed terrorist acts of murder and destruction against the United States, such as the Levant Affair and the attack on the American Navy ship, the USS Liberty? Is it worth it to support a nation that spies on us, such as the Jonathan Pollard case? Is it worth it to support a nation that steals from us, such as the theft of enriched uranium for Israel's illegal atomic bombs? Is it worth it to support a nation that sells our most secret defense technology to America's most dangerous enemy, the Red Chinese? Is it worth it to allow a foreign nation to have the strongest lobby in our own American government? Is it worth it for Israeli agents to bribe American candidates with vast sums of campaign money so they will put the interests of Israel over that of America? The fact that the media could so unanimously cover up the real reason for the attack of September 11 is clear proof of the Jewish supremacism over it. Of course, the real truth is that America was attacked not because we have a truly free press, but because it is controlled by Jewish supremacists. We were attacked not because our government is free, but because of our Israeli controlled and influenced government, as Senator William Fulbright said, one that has directly acted against the most important interests of the American people. Remember my earlier quote from Who Controls the government, from Jewish supremacy in government, where Fulbright said Israel controls the U.S. Senate, right up until September 11. The media daily characterized George Bush as the village idiot who stumbled into the presidency. After Bush embraced Israel's holy war against the Palestinians and their allies, he has suddenly become a great leader who will give us a wonderful victory in the glorious wars ahead. At least, I imagine, as long as he continues to serve the interests of Jewish supremacism. The same leftist Jewish bosses and media personnel who have subverted every true American patriotic interest to Israel's agenda over the past 50 years, and have consistently represented those who wave American flags as ignorant country yahoos, have now put an American flag everywhere in sight and made flag-waving chic. They solemnly tell us that George Bush's campaign to rid the world of evil is not in the least too ambitious. So the record's clear. Israel's the worst terrorist rogue state on earth. Israel and its terrorist leaders, including Ben-Gurion, Begin, Shamir, Barak, and Sharon, have committed a half century of relentless ethnic cleansing, bombings, assassinations, torture, and murder of the Palestinian people. Israel has also committed numerous acts of treachery and terrorism against the United States of America, as I've clearly shown in documenting the Levon affair and the attack on USS Liberty, this Pollard spy case, and a large-scale spying that still continues. Because of the overwhelming Israeli power in media and government, traitors to the United States continue to treasonously betray America with little fear of punishment. Through the efforts of Jewish and Gentile traitors in service to Jewish supremacism, the American government has embarked on a foreign policy that's repeatedly betrayed America's true interests. Massive American military and monetary support has enabled Israel to continue its relentless terrorism against the Palestinians and has thus provoked tremendous hatred against the United States, greatly hurt American economic and strategic interests, and ultimately spawned the terrorism now rising against America and Americans all over the world. The traitors who sacrificed America's security for Israel's criminality are as guilty of the death of 2,800 American lives on September 11 as those who actually hijacked and crashed the planes into the World Trade Center and Pentagon. However, knowing Israel's record of treachery against America, I wondered from the first few moments of the attacks if Israel had played a treacherous role in them. From the dawn of the new century to September 11, 2001, Israel suffered the worst public relations in history. The election of mass murderer Ariel Sharon as prime minister was the last straw for millions of decent-minded people all over the world. The United Nations Conference on Racism, which labeled Israel as an apartheid state, also signaled increased disapproval of Israel. Then suddenly the attack on the World Trade Center changed everything. In a matter of minutes, the world swung back to Israel's favor and has since given rabid Zionists a blank check, which they have quickly cashed, to indiscriminately bomb and kill Palestinians and crush their fledgling new state. Was all this just a fortunate coincidence for Israel? As I've shown earlier in this chapter, Israel has a long and deceitful record of covert treachery against the United States. They are very aware that any Arab terrorist attack on America greatly advances their own aims. The bigger the attack against America, the more carnage, the better it is for Israel. On September 10, 2001, the eve of the World Trade Center attack, the Washington Times ran a story about a recent 68-page study issued by the U.S. Army School for Advanced Military Studies, SAMS. The study, issued by the Elite Army Officers School, detailed the dangers of a possible U.S. Army occupational force in the Mideast. Here is how the article commented about the Israeli Mossad, and I quote, "Of the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, the SAMS officers say, wild card, ruthless, and cunning, has capability to target U.S. forces and make it look like a Palestinian-Arab act," unquote. This came out on the day before 9/11. Ironically, within 24 hours of the story's publication, the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were in flames. Could the ruthless and cunning Mossad, as the U.S. Army officers describe it covertly, have been behind the attack? The Mossad is certainly the most ruthless terrorist organization in the entire world. It's also one of the largest and most sophisticated intelligence organizations. No other nation comes even close to matching its level of infiltration of Arab organization. It prides itself on infiltrating every sizable militant organization on earth. Knowing these facts, there can be little doubt the Mossad has deeply penetrated one of the oldest, largest, and what's considered the most famous and dangerous Arab terrorist organization on the planet, bin Laden's al-Qaeda. Furthermore, the FBI and CIA have clearly stated that the attack on the World Trade Center and Pentagon was a huge covert operation using an international network of at least 100 terrorists spanning three continents. Could Mossad agents and al-Qaeda, as well as the rest of Mossad's vast network of thousands of infiltrators and informants, not have learned about the most extensive and ambitious Arab terrorist operation in history? It is, of course, extremely difficult to prove the precise role of a secretive foreign intelligence organization such as the Mossad in a terrorist act. They are, in fact, a super-secret spy organization. But powerful evidence shows that Israelis had foreknowledge of the September 11 attack on America. And if indeed they had foreknowledge of these murderous attacks of terrorism, and then had the cold-blooded mentality not to warn the United States and avert the disaster, because they saw a horrendous massacre of thousands of Americans as good for Israel, it follows that they would have felt no moral restraint from actually instigating and covertly aiding this terrorist plan through their own agent provocateurs. Now let's look at the hard evidence indicating the Mossad had foreknowledge of the September 11 attack. No Israeli casualties in the World Trade Center. The day after the attack on the World Trade Center, the Jerusalem Post, the most respected and famous Israeli newspaper in the world, reported that 4,000 Israelis were missing after the attack on the World Trade Center. The foreign ministry compiled a number from Israeli relatives who, in the first few hours after the attack, contacted the Israeli foreign ministry and gave the names of Israeli friends and relatives who worked in the World Trade Center, who had business scheduled in it or in its adjacent structures. Even without seeing the article in the Jerusalem Post, logic alone would tell one that there would be many hundreds, if not thousands, of Israelis in the World Trade Center at the time of the attacks. The international Jewish domination of banking, finance, and trade is legendary. Executives in many firms in the trade towers regularly commute back and forth to Israel. As an example of the Israeli presence of the World Trade Center, even the co-owner of the World Trade Center, Frank Lowry, is an Israeli citizen. New York is the center of worldwide Jewish financial power, and the World Trade Center is at its epicenter. One would naturally expect the Israeli death toll to be fairly catastrophic. Jerusalem Post certainly thought so. On September the 12th, 2001, here's the beginning of the article. The headline is Thousands of Israelis Missing Near World Trade Center Pentagon. The foreign ministry in Jerusalem has so far received the names of 4,000 Israelis believed to have been in the areas of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon at the time of the attack. That's the headline in the first sentence of the Jerusalem Post article. When George Bush made his speech before Congress, it turns out that he made a significant numerical error in addition to making the absurd allegation that the World Trade Center attackers did it because they, quote, hated freedom. Bush made it a point to say that in addition to thousands of Americans, 130 Israelis died in the World Trade Center. The implication was to say that Israel shared in our suffering and that we and Israel are in this thing together. Upon hearing the number of 130 Israeli dead, it seemed suspiciously low to me. If 4,000 Israelis were theoretically at the World Trade Center, according to the Jerusalem Post, and the World Trade Center death toll was about 2,800, which is about 10% of the 28,000 people normally in the building at that time, the Israeli toll should have been statistically around 300, not 130. Now, searching through hundreds of articles trying to track down the true Israeli death toll, I finally found a New York Times piece that clarified the precise number of Israelis who died in the World Trade Center attack. It turned out that of the 130 Israelis President Bush claimed had died in the World Trade Center, all but one of them were still alive. And later, by the way, most memorials reduced it to zero. When I learned this, I was incredulous. Good God, I said to myself, only one Israeli? Here is the amazing excerpt I found in the New York Times. Our interviews with many consulate officials Friday suggested that lists of people they were collected varied widely in their usefulness. For example, the city had somehow received reports of many Israelis feared missing at the site, and President Bush, in his address to the country on Thursday night, mentioned that about 130 Israelis had died in the attacks. But Friday, Alan Pincus, Israel's consul general here, said that the list of missing included reports from people who had called in because, for instance, relatives in New York had not returned to their phone calls from Israel. There were, in fact, only three Israelis who had been confirmed as dead, two on the planes, and another who had been visiting the towers on business and who was identified and buried. Now, even, that's unquote, New York Times, September 22nd, even the very low death toll of 130 suggested that a number of Israelis at the Trade Center could have been warned before the attack. When I found out the truth that only one Israeli had died, it erased all reasonable doubt that there had been at least some prior warning for Israelis. Having only one Israeli casualty among the 2,800 dead at the World Trade Center is simply a statistical impossibility. For example, there were two Israeli casualties among the only 157 passengers on the two hijacked domestic flights that struck the World Trade Center. Certainly, there would have had to been a much higher percentage among the over 28,000 people in the Trade Center itself, considering it's the center of world trade and finance and something that Israelis are disproportionately engaged in. Even if the Israeli Foreign Ministry and the Jerusalem Post had grossly overestimated the number of Israelis at the World Trade Center by a factor of 10, there would still have been about 400 Israelis there at the time of the attacks. Even if only a few hundred Israelis were present at the time and only one Israeli death occurred, it's statistically absurd. Either September 11, coincidentally, was a popular Jewish holiday, or at least some of the Israeli citizens at the World Trade Center received some advance warning of the attack. The next thing I researched was to see if there were any confirmed warnings to Israelis, specifically, prior to the attack. I quickly found an article in Newsbytes, a news service of the Washington Post, titled, quote, Instant Messages to Israel Warned of World Trade Center Attack, unquote. The Israeli daily Haaretz also confirmed their prior warnings to Israel and confirmed that the FBI is investigating the warnings. The articles detailed that an Israeli messaging firm, Odigo, with offices in both the World Trade Center and in Israel, received a number of warnings just hours before the attack. Quote, instant messages to Israel warned of World Trade Center attack. Officials at the instant messaging firm Odigo confirmed today that two employees received text messages warning of an attack in the World Trade Center 2 hours before terrorists crashed planes into the New York landmarks. But Alex Diamas, Vice President of Sales and Marketing, confirmed that workers in Odigo's Research and Development and International Sales Office in Israel received a warning from another Odigo user approximately 2 hours prior to the first attack. So now I had some powerful and convincing evidence from impeccable sources showing some Israelis were warned in advance of the attack. First, without a prior warning, how could there have been no Israeli casualties at the World Trade Center? Secondly, there is clear confirmation that an Israeli company with offices in both Israel and the World Trade Center received instant messages warning of the attack in the World Trade Center just hours before it happened. Who would have warned Israelis of the impending attack if not Israel's Mossad? The fact that Israel's government had prior knowledge of this huge, unprecedented attack and had warned potential Israeli victims but then deliberately let thousands of Americans die makes the Israelis just as responsible for the carnage as the Arab kamikazes. As I continued to look into the matter, I figured that it was only a matter of time before information leaked out indicating some Israelis had foreknowledge of the attack, and I didn't have to wait long. The media also ran stories immediately after the attack, reporting the FBI was investigating massive short selling of airlines and insurance stocks right before the attacks. They pointed out that the short selling, betting the stocks would collapse, indicated involvement and prior knowledge in the attacks because the volume of trades in these multiple stocks was 1,000 times greater than normal volume. These trades netted tens of millions of dollars in profits in a number of exchanges in America and Europe. Americans were told by a government official, that the trades would give us a clear trail to those behind the acts. Americans are told that the operatives of bin Laden were probably behind them. Strangely, though, after the initial flurry of articles, there's been nothing at all released on the identity of those who made millions on the transactions. And I suspect that the reason we've heard no more about this is because the profiteers turned out to be not Arab terrorists, but Jewish terrorists. Finally, on December 12th, a major news source broke a story that openly pointed out that the FBI had evidence of Israeli advance knowledge of the attacks. Now, here's an excerpt from the Fox Network news story on the Britt Hume reports. Quote, Britt Hume, host, it's been more than 16 years since a civilian working for the Navy was charged with passing secrets to Israel. Jonathan Pollard pled guilty to conspiracy to commit espionage and is serving a life sentence. At first, Israeli leaders claimed Pollard was part of a rogue operation, but later took responsibility for his work. Now Fox News has learned some U.S. investigators believe that there were Israelis again very much engaged in spying in and on the United States, and who may have known things they didn't tell us before September 11. Carl Cameron, Fox News correspondent. Quote, since September 11, more than 60 Israelis have been arrested or detained either under the new Patriot Anti-Terrorism Law or for immigration violations. A handful of active Israeli military were among those detained, according to investigators who say that some of the detainees also failed polygraph questions when asked about alleged surveillance activities against and in the United States. There is no indication that the Israelis were involved in the 9/11 attacks, but investigators suspect that they, the Israelis, may have gathered intelligence about the attacks in advance and not shared it. Hume, Carl, what about this question of advanced knowledge of what was going to happen on 9/11? How clear are investigators that some Israeli agents may have known something? Cameron, quote, it's very explosive information, obviously, and there's a great deal of evidence that they say they've collected. None of it necessarily conclusive. It's more when they put it all together, a bigger question, they say, is how could they not have known? Almost a direct quote. And that is a direct quote of Carl Cameron's words. It would seem that such information of the uncovering of a vast Israeli spy network in the American nation in the days before 9/11, and that Israel purposefully let thousands of Americans be slaughtered on September 11, it seems that that should have been headline news in every newspaper of America and the lead story in every major news broadcast. It should have caused George Bush to have suspended all aid and diplomatic relations with Israel, at least. But the Jewish press only drones on in silence about these revelations of Israeli treachery. And President Bush, who says he will attack anyone who aided the 9/11 terrorists, remains silent about the fact that Israel was an accessory to the worst terrorist act ever committed against America. By purposefully not warning America, Israel aided this horrendous act of murder and terror. President Bush, by now, must know about Israeli involvement in the September attack. If he remains silent about it, he, too, will become an accessory to murder and a traitor who would cover up the crimes of a foreign enemy. Now, these words, I know, are harsh, and it saddens my heart that I must write about the betrayal of my country by the highest leaders. You can be sure that joy rose in the hearts of all Israeli supremacists as they witnessed the smoke plume rising from the Twin Towers. As I mentioned earlier, the FBI even arrested five Israelis on a rooftop in a white van, videotaping and cheering the event. They knew that American and world resistance to Israel supremacism and terrorism had plummeted right along with the collapse of the towers of the World Trade Center. The Israelis arrested turned out to be Mossad agents, and the owner of the Mossad business front, Dominic Suter, quickly fled to Israel. In early 2002, the French newspaper Le Monde printed a copy of the DEA Drug Enforcement Administration memorandum that gave specifics of the massive Jewish spy operation in America. Among some of the things revealed were the names and addresses of the Mossad agents. This was specific information who were spying on the hijackers in the days before 9/11. Five Israeli agents actually lived on the same street in Hollywood, Florida, as they closely monitored the leader of the 9/11 attacks, Mohammed Atta. Next section is Zionist agent frees Israeli spy ring. One of the highest-ranking Zionist agents in the federal government, Michael Chertoff, committed the final act of treason in connection with the apprehension of the Israeli spy ring. Chertoff was head of the Justice Department's Terrorism Task Force, as well as being head of the Justice Department's Criminal Division. He had authority over the prosecution of the Israeli spy ring, the largest spy ring ever apprehended in the United States of America. The arrested included the five Israeli Mossad agents caught filming and celebrating the first few minutes of the 9/11 attacks. Not only had the 140 apprehended Israeli spies committed easily proven high crimes of conspiracy to commit espionage, they had much material information on the 9/11 terrorists, invaluable for the planned congressional investigation and the 9/11 commission. Prosecution of the Israeli spies on serious life imprisonment espionage charges would have led to plea deals whereby the whole spy ring would have unraveled. Their prosecution and trials would have been a public relations nightmare for Israel and inflicted even greater damage than the Pollard case. It also would have led to public knowledge of Israeli treachery in regard to the 9/11 attacks. Did Israel's treachery consist of not informing us of the planned attacks, or did Israeli Mossad agents and infiltrators in Al-Qaeda itself actually instigate and aid, or perhaps shepherd them? As the Levant affair and the attack on the USS Liberty show, Israel would not have refrained from secretly sponsoring terrorist attacks against the United States if it saw them as strategically advantageous. In one of the most blatant acts of treason in American history, Michael Chertoff quietly dropped charges against the apprehended Israeli spies and let them return to Israel, where they would be completely out of the reach of subsequent investigators.
Later, long after that treachery, I learned even more shocking facts about Michael Chertoff, the man who would later be appointed the head of America's newly created Homeland Security. The next section is Head of Homeland Security Has Close Ties to the Man Who Financed 9/11. In perhaps the most amazing appointment of modern American history, Michael Chertoff became Head of Homeland Security, a powerful position created because of the 9/11 attacks. It turns out that Chertoff has had close ties to the primary suspect alleged to have financed the 9/11 attacks. There is also convincing evidence that Chertoff, as head of the Criminal Division of the U.S. Justice Department, shielded this financier of 9/11 from prosecution in a prior terrorist case. For the citations, again, go to my original copy of the book, and we have all this data documented from major sources. The Record newspaper of Bergen County, New Jersey, on June 20, 2000, shows that Chertoff defended Magdu Elmer, who was then sued by the state of New Jersey for $16.7 million in losses over alleged medical fraud. Over $5.7 million of that amount went to unknown parties by means of wire transfers to bank accounts where the owner of the account is unknown. Now, who is Magdu Elmer, Chertoff's client in 2000? On the NBC program Dateline on August 2, 2002, Representative Ben Gilman, Republican, New York, of the House International Relations Committee, showed that in 1998 that Magdu Elmer had financial ties with Osama bin Laden for years. In fact, Elmer even had strong connections with the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993. Here are the quotes from the transcript. Should counterterrorism investigators take an interest in Dr. Elmer? Well, Dateline obtained a document last fall, Foreign Intelligence Report, that makes a startling allegation about the doctor, that he has had financial ties with Osama bin Laden for years. The report was given to a senior member of Congress, Ben Gilman, back in 1998, when he was chairman of the House International Relations Committee. We have a former FBI person on our staff, and I asked him to look it over, says Congressman Gilman. He thought it was credible enough to turn it over to the intelligence people, and we turned it over to the FBI practically immediately. This was in 1998. The report alleges that an HMO owned by Dr. Elmer in New Jersey was funded by bin Laden, and that in turn Dr. Elmer was skimming money from the HMO to fund terrorist activities. That's from Dateline, August 2nd, 2002. Magdu Elmer was one of the most important financial supporters of the Al-Salam Mosque. The Al-Salam Mosque was where Omar Abdul Rahman preached. He was the Muslim extremist who later was arrested and convicted for his role in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. Former New Jersey police officer Alan Duncan said that even after the first World Trade Center bombing, that, quote, the Jersey City area, and particularly the Al-Salam Mosque, were allowed to continue as a major hub of terrorist activity in the United States. During this period, 1990 to 1994, Chertoff was the U.S. attorney for this area, the District of New Jersey. As U.S. attorney, Chertoff had the responsibility of overseeing the FBI investigation of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. So even though Chertoff had to know of Elmer's connections to the leaders of the mosque who were the 1993 World Trade Center bombers, Elmer later became one of Chertoff's most important clients during the same period that he was being investigated in connection with an arms deal for al-Qaeda. In 1999, Magdu Elmer and his brother, Muhammad, were named suspects in Operation Diamondback, which was an FBI, ATF, undercover infiltration of Pakistani arms dealers who sought money from wealthy Arab Americans to arm Osama bin Laden with conventional and nuclear weapons. According to the testimony of Officer Duncan and taped transcripts with FBI informant Randy Glass, Elmer was a key player in this operation. According to Dateline NBC, Magdu's brother, Muhammad Elmer, tried to purchase small arms and ammunition in a recorded telephone conversation with Glass. Dateline confirmed that Muhammad Elmer and his corporation had paid at least $5,000 to Egyptian arms dealer Diab Motion. Motion was sentenced to 30 months for his involvement in Operation Diamondback. Officer Alan Duncan, who was hired as an investigator by families of the September 11 attacks, said that the reason Elmer was never convicted was because he was never charged with a crime. When Operation Diamondback culminated in arrests in the summer of 2001, Michael Chertoff had become the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Criminal Division of the U.S. Justice Department, and Operation Diamondback came directly under his authority. Michael Chertoff blocked the indictment of his former client, Magdu Elmer. Now, only in an America where the press is so tightly controlled by Jewish extremist partisans could the fact that the man who was head, until this administration, of America's Homeland Security, has had close ties to the man who is the prime suspect in the financing of the 9/11 attacks. There is no question that the Israeli Mossad was shadowing Mohammed Atta and at least half of the other hijackers for months before the 9/11 attack.
When Chertoff permitted dozens of apprehended Mossad agents to go back to Israel, he effectively stopped the 9/11 Investigation Commission from having access to the vital information about the hijackings, and also show the facts of the Israeli foreknowledge of the carnage and their betrayal of America. Next section is my encounter with Michael Chertoff. From Europe in 2002, I appeared live on the Fox Wire program with Rita Cosby on the Fox News Network and denounced the Israeli treachery in 9/11 and the apprehended Israeli spy ring treasonously released by Michael Chertoff. I wrote and spoke exhaustively about the obvious Israeli foreknowledge of the 9/11 attacks, and before the Iraq war, I began to attack the weapons of mass destruction lie and became one of the biggest American critics of the coming war in Iraq, a war for Israel. It was interesting and newsworthy across Europe and in the Middle East. It was fascinating to them that a former American elected official, a conservative Republican, took the strong stand against the upcoming Iraq war. The neocons in the Bush administration made serious efforts to block my work around the world. In November of 2002, I traveled to Qatar and did a primetime interview with Al Jazeera exposing Jewish supremacism and the treason going on against America. Newsweek magazine reported that the Jewish-dominated State Department actually threatened the Al Jazeera network in an attempt to prevent my appearance. Here are the words of Newsweek. This is from Newsweek Periscope, November 25th, 2002, by Mark Hosenball. Quote, but U.S. officials are keeping an eye on Al Jazeera's programs. One example, on November 13, a talk show featured David Duke, who was labeled as an ex-GOP representative from Louisiana. Duke once served in the Louisiana House of Representatives. Duke used the airtime to vent an assortment of anti-Semitic canards, saying Israel sat on warnings of 9/11, and Israelis in the Twin Towers were warned to evacuate 2 hours before the attacks. The State Department lodged a protest with Al Jazeera over the Duke broadcast. An administration official said Al Jazeera would be subject to the same kind of message discipline, unquote, reduced access for hostile coverage that the White House uses to goad American media outlets. That's from Newsweek magazine, November 25th, 2002. The government's attempt to suppress my freedom of speech was unconstitutional and, of course, patently illegal. It violated my civil rights and the guarantees of the Constitution of the United States of freedom of speech and press. I was not charged or convicted of any crimes, but the federal government tried to prevent my voice from being heard. I was soon to find out that they had other, more effective, illegal methods to suppress American dissidents. In America, no hate laws, in quotes, can be applied to repress those dissidents who dare to expose Jewish supremacists. So application of complicated financial and tax laws are their favorite weapon of choice to discredit and hinder enemies. Shortly after I was elected to the House of Representatives in 1990, I came under a legal onslaught. During the time I campaigned for U.S. Senator and later for Louisiana Governor, 7 financial audits were launched against me. They carried on for years. I was intensively investigated and audited by almost every government entity possible. I had personal income tax audits for both the federal government and the state of Louisiana, audits for my organization, audits for my business activities, full investigations and audits going on for my U.S. Senate campaign and my campaign for governor. Even a sales tax investigation in my home parish county of Jefferson in Louisiana. No criminal wrongdoing was found in all these audits, but the enormous personal financial costs of accountants and lawyers brought me to the edge of bankruptcy. Then in 1998, under the African-American U.S. Attorney Eddie Jordan, an ardent political enemy, by the way, he launched a new investigation for tax and mail fraud, which also had resulted in no indictment against me. Shortly after my appearance in Al Jazeera and my tireless work against the war in Iraq, some 5 years later, I was informed that Michael Chertoff had authorized an indictment of me on those same tax and financial matters. In any sort of financial accusation, it is possible for the federal government to make multiple charges and counts for the same offense, which can absolutely result in decades of imprisonment. I was informed that unless I accepted a plea arrangement and face a fairly short term of imprisonment, I would face an indictment on multiple counts that could well put me in federal prison for the rest of my life. I had no illusions about the lack of real justice found in the federal court system. I was in a district where half the federal judges were dedicated Jewish extremists, and I knew that any jury in the New Orleans area would be surely composed of many non-Europeans who fervently voted against me for governor and for U.S. Senator. In a divide-and-conquer scenario, the Jewish partisan, New Orleans Times-Picayune, and other media had convinced these people that I was a white supremacist and the devil personified. No matter how such a jury might try to be fair, I knew that it would be almost impossible for them to overcome their prejudices. My lawyer, James McPherson, who I trusted and who had many years' experience in the federal courts, told me that in these kinds of cases, the federal government has many advantages, and told me that the system is not really a fair one. I realized that it would be reckless to take the risk of losing a long and costly trial, which could result in being locked up for the rest of my life. Quote, "Are you really willing to take that risk?" he asked me. You have many years left of work that you can still do for your beliefs. You can accept this plea and still continue your work, or you can risk having your voice stilled forever. So as painful as it was for me to do it, I accepted the plea. In the courtroom at sentencing, the judge ordered the IRS to do an extensive audit of the year for which I was charged with tax fraud in order to determine how much money I had, quote, defrauded from the federal government by filing a false tax return for the year of 1998. An IRS team was assembled to investigate my taxes for 1998. An African-American woman led the team and ran the investigation while I was far away in federal prison in Big Spring, Texas. Of course, from there I could offer little evidence or help my defense very much in terms of my side of that 1998 tax year. After an intensive investigation, I finally received the result of their audit in a letter from the IRS dated August 11, 2003. I reproduced this letter in my book, My Awakening, and in my book, Jewish Supremacism. As I sat in the crowded cell, we had large barracks-type cells at that prison, I began to laugh out loud. Some of my friends gathered around curiously. I showed them the results of the IRS investigation into the tax charges for the year 1998 that put me in prison. Department of Treasury date of this notice, August 11, 2003. And here's what it read. Internal Revenue Service, tax period, December, ending December 31st, 1998. Austin, Texas. David E. Duke, amount of overpaid tax on your return, $6,406.08. It turned out that the African-American lady that led the audit task force was indeed an honest woman, and I am thankful to her for reporting honestly what she had uncovered through their months of audit and research. The fact that I'd actually overpaid my taxes by $6,406 for the tax year of 1998, the year that the government alleged that I had cheated my taxes, is incredibly revealing. I told my friends as they gathered around me, "Now it's official," I said. "I definitely should be locked up because anybody who would overpay the federal government $6,000 in taxes should be in prison." I leave it to the reader to decide if Michael Chertoff's persecution of me at the same time I tried to expose his role in freeing the Israeli spies connected to 9/11 and his relationship with the man suspected of financing 9/11, Magdu Elmer, whether these things were coincidental. 9/11, good for Israel. Perhaps one of the most telling statements was recorded by a New York Times reporter when he questioned the former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a man every bit as barbaric as Ariel Sharon. Here are the words of the excited former Israeli Prime Minister. Quote, asked tonight what the attack meant for relations between the United States and Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, the former prime minister, replied, quote, "It's very good," unquote. Then he edited himself, "Well, not very good, but it will generate immediate sympathy," unquote. Sharon and his fellow Jewish supremacists did not warn American authorities and save thousands of American lives because they knew such a horrible event would reverse all of Israel's recent losses. September 11 would be a 21st century Pearl Harbor, galvanizing the American people for war, their war. Of course, not warning America about the impending attacks would make Israel a cold-blooded accomplice in mass terror and murder. But please tell me, when has Israel or Ariel Sharon shrunk from such treachery? Zionists have never worried about the loss of innocent lives to achieve their ends. The Israeli state was founded on terror such as perpetrated at Deir Yassin when Menachem Begin's thugs brutally murdered over 250 men, women, and children. Only Jewish supremacists would have the chutzpah to then purposefully publicize the atrocity in order to terrorize the Palestinians into fleeing from their homes and lands. And as I already pointed out, Ben-Gurion purposefully even blew up an entire ship of his own people appropriately on Christmas Day, back in the earliest days of Zionism, to accomplish his supremacist objectives. One fact is irrefutable. Zionists are as responsible for the attack on America just as surely as if they themselves had piloted those plane bombs. It was caused by the Jewish control of the American media and Congress and its blind support of over 50 years of Israeli terrorism and murder against the Palestinians and other peoples of the Mideast. Their supremacism over America can be illustrated by the fact that the American government has continued to support Israel with guns and money even after it committed direct acts of terrorism and treachery against the United States, such as in the Levant affair, the assault on the USS Liberty, and in the ongoing spying and sabotaging of American interests. The truth is that Zionists not only seek Jewish supremacism over the hapless Palestinians, they seek supremacism over all of us, no matter what our race or nationality. It's not just America they want supremacy over. It's Canada and Britain and France and Germany and Russia and every other nation upon the earth. Jewish supremacists already control the Hollywood movie and television industry, music, and the news media that so strongly influenced the entire civilized world. They're the most powerful single force, in fact, an irresistible force in the government of the United States. Through that control, they also direct the most powerful military might the world has ever known and can thus extend their supremacism even to nations where their power is not as pervasive as in the United States. The Jewish supremacists have purposefully orchestrated the non-European immigration that will dispossess European Americans the same way that Jewish immigration into Palestine has displaced the Palestinians. They have consciously led the effort to make European Americans a minority in our own country, as they made Palestinians a minority in Palestine. They seek nothing less than to destroy the genetic, cultural identity and nationalism of all peoples other than their own. While they preach open borders for us, they preach ultra-nationalism for their own people and support for Israel, which has not a religious, but essentially a genetic requirement or heritage requirement for immigration. The inescapable truth is that Jewish supremacists hate the European people and Christians just as much as they hate Muslim Arabs and Palestinians. They teach their children fear and hatred toward all Gentiles, and they endlessly recite Christian and Muslim persecutions against them. Their media teaches hatred of their Gentile enemies, from Pharaoh to Haman to Hitler and Hussein. Their hate propaganda is as ancient as the Talmud and as modern as movies such as the horrifying fiction of Schindler's List. The most popular website in all of Israel illustrates the vicious anti-European bias of Jewish supremacism. It's called Gamla News and Views, and it was instrumental in the 1996 elections in Israel that brought the Likud and Netanyahu to power. Articles appear in Hebrew and English. Usually, articles in all Hebrew publications are far more vehement against Gentiles than those they translate into English, but the following article appears in English on their site and is written by the most popular commentator, Emmanuel Winston. In anger over American and European urging of Israel to make peace with the Palestinians, Winston let out the true feelings of Jewish supremacist hatred toward European Americans. Perhaps nothing better illustrates that it is not only the Palestinians they seek to ethnically cleanse and wipe out, but European and Americans as well. As any prostitute, and this is a direct quote from Emmanuel Winston from one of the largest websites in Israel, as any prostitute can tell you for a fee, they will agree to do anything you want. The Europeans are really a low, immoral people that would sell their mother and then deliver. How easily any sense of humanity, of civilization, slips away from their face, leaving only the beast. This beast has many faces and names. Sometimes they are called Germans, Poles, Croatians, Ukrainians, while other times they become the Church, the Red Cross, our prime ministers, kings, Führer. Then in a quick change, we see some Americans, French, English, and finally, there is the contaminated Jew called the leftist. It doesn't really matter, this name or that. Underneath, there is a strand, a bond that society teaches children to hate the other, the different ones. These are people of ultimate evil, as the beast stays just below the surface, ready to savage, ready to kill the Jew. Unquote. Now, immediately after this obscenely hateful Jew calls Europeans prostitutes and beasts, Winston then hypocritically alleges that Europeans teach children to hate the other, the different ones, which he means to be Jews. The truth is, of course, that the very core of Judaism teaches hatred of Gentiles, as Mr. Winston is expressing in this very article. Winston goes on to blatantly cheer the genocide of the European people, and I quote, "The planet would be well rid of the European predator. Perhaps we will be fortunate to live in such interesting times," an old Chinese curse, "to see the decline and disappearance of the graveyard called Europe. The Europeans, the English, and the American Arabists once again come together and crack the whip over the Jews." Now let me again repeat. Gamla is the top website in Israel and supported by major Jewish political figures such as Benjamin Netanyahu. Winston calls for the ridding of the planet of the European people. The article is nothing less than a call for genocide. Imagine for a moment if any major commentator in America called Jews prostitutes and beasts and said, quote, the planet would be well rid of the Jewish predator. Perhaps we will be fortunate to live in such interesting times to see the decline and disappearance of the graveyard called Israel." Unquote. And by the way, I'm reluctant to make that quote on this tape because I can just see our enemies taking the tape and saying this is what David Duke believes instead of showing how that this is what they are saying about us. Now contemplate the outcry if any Christian commentator made such a statement about Jews. In most countries of Europe, the offender would be charged with a hate crime and sent to prison. Even American activists who have academically contested some historical aspects of the Holocaust have been put into jail when they've touched down on European soil, such as in Germany. Do you think Mr. Emanuel Winston faces that possibility? Don't hold your breath. This paranoid Jewish supremacist accuses the very same people who have most supported Israel and all of its terrible suppression against the Palestinians as, quote, hating Jews. After calling Europeans beasts and prostitutes and ardently hoping for a genocide, he then claims it's Europeans who are the hateful ones. Such is typical of the 14-carat Jewish supremacist hypocrisy that deluges the Western world. Jewish supremacists have also been the instigators of the globalism that is sweeping away American sovereignty and truly the freedoms, the economic independence, and the cultural values of all nations. They are the architects of so-called hate laws that are the modern equivalent of medieval laws against blasphemy or heresy. Only this time, it is the state and media-sponsored religion of Jewish supremacism that is beyond questioning. In the wake of the September attacks of 2001, and the subsequent global war against terrorism that follows, they orchestrate the most massive infringement of rights and freedom in history. They're setting up a world government and world police state that will make it a serious criminal offense to utter a word against their hatred and supremacism. They think of themselves as the new gods, and those who love freedom, they're designated as the new heretics. They're even preparing for us dungeons and torture chambers similar to the Bolshevik Red Terror. Jewish pundits and even famous Jewish, quote, civil libertarians such as Alan Dershowitz are now calling for the legalization of torture. Am I an alarmist? Were the early Palestinian resistance fighters alarmists when they said that the Zionist settlers coming to Palestine in the 1940s had not come to live as good neighbors, but to take their country and enslave their people? Were the white Russians alarmists when they warned that the Jewish Bolsheviks would wipe away freedom and cast Mother Russia into a sea of blood? Actually, the reality of Jewish Bolshevism was far worse than anything envisioned by the most vehement critics of Jewish supremacism. Were political untouchables like Patrick Buchanan and myself alarmists when we warned that Americans would suffer international acts of terror and murder by supporting the crimes of the Zionist state? Were we wrong in predicting that at the cost of American lives and billions of American dollars that America would be used to go fight wars for Israel, no matter how harmful they would be for American interests at home and abroad? The acknowledged primary advocates and architects of the 1993 Iraq War were Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz, two Jewish supremacists whose loyalty is to Israel, not America. They are part of the Jewish neocon group who are not actually neoconservatives, but truly neo-communists. For neoconservatism was founded by Leo Strauss, an admitted, dedicated follower of Leon Trotsky, along with all the leading Jewish founders of so-called neoconservatism. The only difference between the new neoconservatives and the old Trotskyites is that these men are open about their Jewish extremism, while Trotsky better hid the true Jewish aspect and design of the Russian Revolution. In fact, he changed his name from Bronstein to the Russian name of Trotsky. There was no greater treachery than for these Jewish supremacists to have involved America into wars against the interest of our own nation. How many more wars must we fight for Israel, and what will be the final cost and ultimate end? As I write these lines and speak these lines to you on this audio tape, for this latest edition, the Jewish supremacists are already cranking up hatred for a war against Iran, a war that would be devastating to the American people and the world. In my preface, I quoted Ben-Gurion's vision of the future he made in Look magazine in 1962. In Jerusalem, the United Nations, a truly united nations, will build a shrine of the prophets to serve the federated union of all continents. This will be the seat of the Supreme Court of mankind. I wonder if you, dear listener, after hearing hundreds of pages of my awakening, might now share my fears that Ben-Gurion's dark dreams are dangerously close to fulfillment. Is my fear only some anti-Semitic nightmare? Or will the reader find it a healthy reaction to the ravings and dangers of unbridled Jewish supremacism? Jewish supremacism is by far the most critical issue of the 21st century world. Jewish supremacism is a term synonymous with terror. Israel is a terrorist state that has committed terror against not just the Palestinians, but against America and the American people. Jewish extremism and supremacism strikes against the very heart of the two most precious things in life for every people on earth: survival and freedom. The next chapter is chapter 25, A Holocaust Inquiry. And this deals with the struggle for freedom of speech on this issue and the defense of the idea that there should be freedom on all points of view. I think you're going to find the next chapter very, very interesting.